Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have a lot of things to protect our country against. It is grist for our mill. It's hard on the country, however, and we try to make sense of it so as to both keep you equipped to understand what the stakes are, notably in this fall's elections, but also the sorts of things that we ought to be doing to mitigate these dangers. A man who's given a lot of thought to all of this and is marvelously contributing to our thinking is our first guest. He is Bill Walton, a regular, usually in this slot each week. He is the host of his own television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show. He brings a lot of experience to bear of relevance to our topics, notably as a former master of the universe, as they call them, on Wall Street, chairman of Allied Capital. Also, he has run a very important conservative movement organization, the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. We're delighted always to say hello. Bill, welcome.
Frank, good talking with you.
I want to start with China, as we often do with you, Bill. There's a very nasty problem that's looming with respect to China's so-called no-limits partner, Vladimir Putin, and Russia. Putin, it seems, is dead set on having his way in Ukraine, and if that means using nuclear weapons, apparently that is decidedly in prospect. Could happen, presumably with so-called tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons to demonstrate his willingness to do more and to see what he can do to exact concessions from the West, if not from the Ukrainians themselves, through our Ukraine. It would be, you know, presumably some kind of surrender on their part. China is essentially enabling that prospect by supporting Putin, by buying his oil, by buying his coal, by buying his gas, and otherwise, it seems, enabling a lot of his mischief here. One of the things that has come to my attention is the possibility that if China is not pressed to prevent Putin from doing it, they've got more leverage on him than we do at this point, they might be a beneficiary of such tactical nuclear use, especially if it enhances their ability to threaten Taiwan with kind of nuclear blackmail. What are your thoughts on all of this? Should we be concerned about it? And most especially, should we be pressing the Chinese, perhaps with, you know, the prospect of our needed, frankly, disengagement from China, rather than letting this run its course?
Well, my view, Frank, is that if we had a serious foreign policy establishment, we'd be pressing not only China, but we'd be pressing Russia, and we'd be pressing Ukraine to get to the table and settle this. I mean, Russia's suffered some tactical setbacks, which has made Putin vulnerable and dangerous. And I think we're at a moment in time here where, if he's rattling the nuclear option around, we ought to take it seriously. And there's some people in the foreign policy establishment in this country that don't think he would ever do that. Well, you and I believe that's wrong. And the thing to keep in mind with nuclear tactical nukes is they're really just small nuclear bombs. They're not something that's different from a big nuclear bomb. And then you get something started there, God knows where it ends. And so we've got to do everything in our power to make sure that doesn't happen. And you're right, China's kept Russia going through all this. I mean, Russia really financially is doing pretty well. I mean, their economy, parts of it are hurt. And of course, the mobilization that Putin's ordered has been a big problem internally for him. But China and a partnership and the oil sales to China and the gas sales or fossil fuel sales to India as well have kept Putin going. They have leverage. And I think we ought to be doing everything we can to talk to all the actors to wrap up what's going on in Ukraine, settle on some borders, settle on a on a on a on an agreement about NATO and whether you know recognizing that Ukraine should not be part of NATO, and try to move on from there. This is one of the most critical points I can think of in history. I mean, this is when people are talking nukes, you got to get serious about that.
Yeah. And honestly, we ought to be disengaging from China anyway. That seems to me to be obvious, especially ending this practice, which you're very familiar with, of underwriting its operations. But clearly tying any further collaboration in these regards has to be contingent upon China using its influence with Putin to bring this to an end, and certainly preventing any nuclear action. Bill, speaking of China, there have been reports since we last talked about something amiss with Xi Jinping. We've been talking for, months, I guess, at least, if not longer, about his impending coronation at a party congress currently scheduled for the 16th of October. And yet there were wild rumors circulating last week that the People's Liberation Army had actually removed him as its leader and maybe even put him under house arrest. I've seen no evidence to support any of that, yet the rumors persist. What are your thoughts on Xi's actual status at the moment?
Well, Xi's been known to disappear for periods of time throughout his regime, and so this his absence on the public stage is not unusual. And if you look at the other signs in Beijing and around China, it looks pretty much like business as usual. You look at photos of the public squares; the normal people are coming and going, and there is a lot of pushback now on Xi and his zero tolerance, zero COVID strategy, and also his attack on the tech companies. And he's made a lot of enemies in China that he didn't have 5 years ago. Last time he was, or 4 years ago, I guess, can't remember his term, 5 years, I think, when he was elected president. So there are those forces there, but, he's got such a tight control over what comes and goes in China and the people. And of course, we talked last week about the incredible surveillance state that he's put in place. So I'm in the camp that it's unlikely that this has actually happened, but that somebody's making some mischief. From my world, probably some hedge fund is trying to trade against the currency or something like that.
Possibly. And I'm going to come back to the renminbi in a moment, but the more Machiavellian among us think this may be a way of smoking out some of those enemies and allowing him to dispense with them before
this party Congress. That's exactly what you would do if you wanted to find out who was going to come out of the woodwork and move against
you. Try to dance on your grave. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bill, about the renminbi, there's been a sharp decline in its value relative to the dollar. What should we make of that?
Well, part of it's fundamental economic in that the real estate market continues to be collapsing in China. Economic growth could slow to 2-3%, and compare that to where they were 5 years ago, where they were at 10-12%. Big concerns about the lockdowns affecting supply chain and the ability to continue to be the export economy that they've always been. And so there's a fundamental reason that their currency should be weak. Historically, the central bank of China has always supported it and kept it up. They're not doing that right now, and it is slipping. I should note, though, that all currencies right now are slipping against the dollar.
Which is not necessarily evidence of its strength. It's just the strongest of the weakest. We're going to come back with more on that point. Bill Walton is in the house. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Earlier this month, the people of Sweden, a nation long misruled by the left, repudiated their elites and voted for a government dominated by the right's Swedish Democrats. Yesterday, a similar political earthquake brought to power in Italy, a right-wing coalition led by a Thatcheresque Giorgia Meloni. The implications of such tectonic shifts for these two countries remain to be seen, but the message to the European Union and other globalists seems clear. National sovereignty and accountable government that protects it from distant bureaucrats and illegal immigrants now enjoy unprecedented popular support. For us, the question is, to what extent are such sentiments next going to dominate our elections this fall? Clearly, the United States is in at least as urgent a need of a course correction as Europe, and we must pray that America will secure a mandate for it as well. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are starting our week off with Bill Walton, as we often do. He is a producer and director and star of a really important television program of his own, The Bill Walton Show. And it gives us an opportunity to cross-pollinate on these programs, which I always welcome. Bill, you were just talking about the relative strength of the dollar, which is astonishing given what's being done to its value by the seemingly endless printing presses that the United States government is operating under the Biden team to inevitably reduce the value of our currency, no?
Well, it's a relative world, Frank, and it's by relative comparisons, the United States looks pretty good compared to Europe or China or Japan. And for that matter, the UK, although the UK has got a new leader and perhaps they're going to see some uptick in their economic growth. But yeah, I mean, it's astonishing. Our deficits are all time high, both in terms of our annual budget deficit and also the amount of debt we have relative to GDP. We're running close to 8-9% inflation. And yet dollar is considered the safe haven. And I think that's not irrational, because if you look at the way the EU is conducting itself, you're not really believing that they're that stable, nor obviously China. So that's the way markets work. They flee to the
seeming safe haven.
And right now the dollar is it.
As some say, the cleanest of the dirty shirts. It's another way of thinking of it. Bill, speaking of buffeting of the EU, we're going to talk about this more with George Raisley momentarily, but I did want to get your thoughts on the emergence of Giorgia Meloni as the new prime minister in waiting of Italy. She has been widely reviled, most especially by the Eurocrats in Brussels. But yet really demonstrated the potency of the right now, much as we saw in Sweden recently. And what do you think the implications are of that for, well, her own country, perhaps, but for Europe as well?
Well, if the bureaucrats in Brussels don't like you, you must be doing something right. I think this is part of the pushback we're seeing from the Ukraine sanctions and the incredible amount of pain that's been inflicted on the European people. And, you know, the natural gas sales, what are roughly 40% of Europe's natural gas was coming from Russia. They're scrambling to replace that. But then you've got, you know, policy wonks in Brussels saying, well, it's really not so bad. You know, we can probably get through the winter if we just lower the thermostat to 58 degrees, or we reduce demand for petrol or gasoline. And they're basically saying we can get through it if all of our people are miserable. And I don't think I know the Americans didn't vote for that as a policy to protect Ukraine, and I don't think the Europeans did either. And I think that's beginning to filter into the politics.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a good thing. Wait till the winter. Yeah, it's going to get a lot more sporty, and a tough start to a new premiership for Meloni if everything is really going to get very, very bleak in her country within the next couple of months. We'll be watching that closely. Bill, let me ask you, speaking of fuel, there is a belief that America's oil buffer, as it's being called, has been essentially eliminated due to, I guess, principally the policies of this administration. We're certainly seeing it depleting our emergency stocks in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But talk us through what else is afoot here.
Well, in a fit of political theater, the Biden administration has chosen to reduce our strategic petroleum reserves, and as they say, to provide more supply so that consumers are not hurt by rising gasoline prices. Well, what they've done is they've taken our strategic reserves down to the lowest level since 1984. I think it's roughly over 400 million barrels, and they're continuing to do that. And you know, they're putting us in a very, very tough position. So some shock that would be caused, say, by a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine that would disrupt the world oil supply, we'd be left with a bare cupboard. And you know, you can argue that this is a drop in the bucket relative to the world supply of petroleum. But everything in economics operates at the margin, and you take a little bit out, and it has a huge effect on price and our ability to meet demands in emergency just is not there right now. Of course, that's true with a lot of the armaments that we sold to. Were given to Ukraine. I mean, our cupboard's bare in a lot of our essential military equipment, and
which makes all the more problematic, as you say, the reliance on foreign states for critical supplies, notably in some cases, in a lot of cases, China.
Frank, you and I've talked. You really have to question this administration's desire to protect America's interest. Near term and long term, and they seem to be more interested in the approval of the European elites than they are in protecting ordinary Americans. And this oil reserve, this petroleum reserve, is just another example in a long list.
I've got, as you know, a rather more critical assessment of it. I think it's a wrecking operation, Bill. I think that it's not just pandering to the globalists at Davos and the like. It's really a Marxist takedown of our country. And I think the evidence is continuing, as you say, to accrue that there really isn't any policy that's in the works, being applied, has been followed by this administration since it came to office, that isn't one, bad for America, and two, it seems pretty consistently positive for the Chinese Communist Party and others who wish us ill. Bill, speaking of the CCP, one more question on this. There have been reports of late that the Chinese have taken advantage of the placement in our most sensitive national laboratory, arguably Los Alamos, to have people trained in and gaining access to information that is enhancing weapon systems of the People's Liberation Army designed to kill us. You know, this is a mind-boggling prospect. And unfortunately, it goes, as I recall, back to the time of Bill Clinton, when he was romancing the Chinese. They were giving him money for his campaign and so on. I remember the Energy Secretary, Hazel O'Leary, at the time, visited, I think it was Los Alamos, if I'm not mistaken, and noticed that the Chinese nationals there had different badge colors than the Americans. And she insisted that that was not fair, that everybody had to have the same badge color. Different markings on them, yes, but you know, making it that much harder to tell who is playing for the other team in our most sensitive facilities. This just makes my head explode when I think about it. But it seems like, again, you know, the malfeasance is rife today, but it's been with us for some time.
Well, it's just the latest example, Frank. I mean, Peter Schweitzer has written, I think, quite well on the elite capture strategy that the Chinese have used everywhere in the world, and in particular here, and in particular focused on the research and scientific community, and even digging down even more into our military research capability. And, you know, this notion that there was this notion that having a different color badge was somehow racist.
Yeah. Mind-boggling. Yes. Well said. Bill, we have to leave it at that. We're going to come back, actually, at the end of the program with a highlight reel of a webinar that Peter Schweitzer participated in, and you're going to want to stay tuned for that. It's all about elite capture. Bill, thank you for joining us. Come back to us next week. Be right back with George Raisley right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is what I call our resident genius here at Securing America. He is a member of the Mensa Society, which qualifies him as such. He's a very smart guy, at the very least, and a wealth of experience, particularly in the political space. George Raisley is his name. He has worked on over 300 political campaigns during the course of his career, including a number at the national level, indeed for the presidency. He served as an aide to a vice president of the United States. He's worked on Capitol Hill. He knows his way around both Washington and the national political scene, upon which he writes and comments regularly as the editor of Richard Viguerie's splendid newsletter, Conservative HQ. Always welcome here. George, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Frank, and to all your viewers. It's not my fault, whatever's happening in Washington today. I'm long
no,
gone.
No, it's not. It's not. But you know a lot about it. And what we want to do is pick your brains about why it's happening and what it means for the rest of us. But actually, I want to start overseas first, if I could, George. There is a new phenomenon taking place in Europe, it would seem. Social Democrats won the election of the premiership of Sweden and are forming a government now. And Giorgia Meloni has just won that held yesterday in Italy. And I'm very interested in whether you see this as a trend, whatever it means for the respective countries. That, I guess, remains to be seen. But what it means for Europe, the European experiment, as it's been called, is something I think we can begin to forecast. And I'd be interested in your take.
Well, I think there's a worldwide trend toward more conservative government, more personal liberty, less bureaucracy. And of course, the hallmark of the European experiment, as you call it, is a massive, unelected, unaccountable bureaucracy located in Brussels. In fact, years ago, I did a paper on the, at that time, the commercial law of what was the European Economic Community when I was at Oxford. So, and again, a very bureaucratic system way back in, you know, in the ancient days when I was there and the monks ran Oxford. So,
Well, that was that was a time ago, George. So, if, and I think the key word that you use there is accountability, and that's really the problem with this European experiment, European enterprise, whatever you want to call it, the European Union now. It is unaccountable to the people of Europe. Yes, there's a parliament, but the parliament doesn't really dictate what is being done in the name of Europe, let alone what is then mandated on all of these ostensibly sovereign nations. Hungary, of course, has been a particular object of vitriol coming out of Brussels because it has dared to stand up to those unaccountable bureaucrats. Yeah. And is it your expectation that what we're going to see in Europe, most obviously and immediately, is real pressure against the European Union, but also possibly, if past precedent is any guide, Brexit having, it seemed, helped catalyze the success of Donald Trump in 2016. Repercussions here as well?
Well, I think that the demand of educated citizens for accountability from their leaders is a worldwide phenomenon. And, you know, it goes beyond replacing pence and shillings for the decimal system in Great Britain and stuff like that. I mean, people in the Western world are fed up with being bossed around by faceless bureaucrats. And it doesn't matter whether you're in Italy, Sweden, Great Britain, or the United States. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of post-Enlightenment Western civilization is this notion that the people are sovereign, and although imperfectly recognized across Western civilization, that idea has a resurgence in these days after, you know, 50 years of the erosion of liberty in Western countries.
Yes. That's the good news. And I hope that it will, in fact, manifest itself in the form of a mandate to those standing for elective office in this country this fall.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the commitment to America that the ranking Republican in the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, has unveiled with some fanfare in, of all places, my birthplace, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, last week. George, you've had a chance to study this contract with America 2.0, some would have called it. How does it look? Does it, to your mind, create the basis for the kind of mandate that we just spoke of?
Well, rather than contract with America 2.0, I'd call it contracted with America 0.75. It's really, you know, it's indicative of the problem that the congressional Republican leadership has, which is an unwillingness to commit to specifics. I mean, it's full of generalities that probably half of Democrats would delightedly agree to and then never vote for a bill to implement. And that's the problem. The contract with America had some very specific things that a new Republican Congress was going to do. And this has none of that. It has statements of, you know, support or opposition to various issues. All are
platitudes, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Platitudes. Yeah. And
and to the extent that they were platitudes, it seems as though their kind of leitmotif is somebody poll tested the platitude to establish that all of them would enjoy majority support. And partly, as you say, because at the platitudinous level, Democrats could buy onto it as happily as Republicans. But some of the things that really struck me as falling short of the mark were they talked about the illegal immigration problem and that they were going to really get tough on that, which, again, I think is probably an 80% roughly issue at this point. It's been such a disaster. But they're not going to complete the wall. They wouldn't commit to completing the wall that Donald Trump substantially built but did not get to finish. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think you're talking about, is it not, George?
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the more salient examples. I mean, there was no commitment to complete the wall. There's no commitment there to eject the 2 million illegal aliens that Biden has allowed into our country. There's not even a commitment to eject the lawbreakers among them. And so
the drug traffickers, the human traffickers, the terrorists, who knows who all else.
Exactly.
And I would think that those would be pretty popular commitments to make too, but it goes, I guess, really to your larger point. They don't want to be held accountable for delivering on these broad, sweeping, platitudinous, if you will, commitments, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you go back and look at who's still in Congress among those that did not support Trump's efforts to build the wall. There's a lot of Republicans in there, or alleged Republicans, I should say. And so, you know, McCarthy and his alleged leadership cohort are, you know, they're not going to hold their colleagues' feet to the fire to actually vote for any specific bills. And conservatives have a lot of these bills, but unfortunately, you know, they're not sponsored by the current leadership in the House Republican Conference.
Nor, and this is really the crux of the matter, it seems to me, nor will they be in a new election if this majority that is widely expected is put into office on the basis of nothing more than the generalities. And that's the rub, George, is it not? I was imprinted, as listeners to this program know, back in the 1980 campaign, when Ronald Reagan very explicitly committed, among other things, to bringing down the Soviet Union. You know, and he got a mandate to do that. And based on that mandate, he and the Congress set about executing it. And I just fear that if it's left this way, well, first of all, you may not get the votes that you are seeking, let alone the mandate for action that the country so desperately needs. George, we have to take a very short break. We're going to come back and talk with you a bit more about what do we do now in that regard. And also the efforts that are being made by the Biden administration to savage MAGA and what the effect is actually looking like. get into all of that and more with George Raceley right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Are we sleepwalking towards catastrophe? Preoccupied with this fall's election or simply the day-to-day challenges of making ends meet in increasingly difficult economic circumstances, most Americans are missing some very ominous indicators of serious trouble ahead. So it would seem, are our intelligence services and national security agencies, perhaps because they're focused instead on Joe Biden's political opposition, now officially designated enemies of the state? Historically, however, our nation would be on high alert if any of the following were occurring, let alone, as now, all of them. The Kremlin is mobilizing its military reserves and explicitly threatening nuclear war. Communist China has massively increased its military capabilities and is adopting a war footing. North Korea has publicly embraced preemptive nuclear strikes, and Iran will have the bomb at any moment. Sorry to disturb, but we ignore such developments at our extreme peril. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. George Raceley, the editor-in-chief of Conservative HQ, Richard Viguerie's terrific newsletter, is in the house with us virtually. We're always delighted to catch up with him, especially at a moment like this in the immediate run-up to elections that are widely described as the most important of all, certainly of our lifetimes, I think. And that's because the country so clearly, so desperately needs a course correction. And the question is, can we get there from here? And we've been discussing a little bit of Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, and his team's commitment to America, as they call it, which seems to me maybe an adequate start, but totally inadequate as a basis for the kind of mandate that those who seek our votes must have for the course correction. And George, one of the features of all of this is, of course, what's going on at the hands of the Democrats to try to vilify and suppress the votes of particularly so-called MAGA Republicans, Make America Great Again Republicans, people who supported Donald Trump, people who are conservatives, people who are patriots. Well, tens of millions of Americans, I think it's fair to say. You have a piece at Conservative HQ in which you talk about the cumulative effect of all of these attacks by the Biden and other Democrat leadership, especially, is strengthening MAGA. Walk us through that and whether that may be the saving grace.
Well, there's certainly a fair amount of solid objective evidence that, for example, the raid on Mar-a-Lago backfired. Trump enjoyed a massive increase in donations to his PAC. After that, his support in various polls bumped up significantly, although it's, you know, receded a little bit, as polls always do. But there's also a lot of anecdotal evidence from, you know, places like coffee shops, diners, bars, bait shops, gun shops, where regular Joes hang out, that, you know, they're not intimidated by this, quite the opposite. They're fired up. And so, for example, when the Biden Justice Department, using justice rather
loosely,
goes out and arrests a pro-life street preacher in Pennsylvania, the rest of pro-life activists get the message that if Biden stays in office, we could be next. And so they're highly motivated by these attacks. And the granular level of these attacks, I mean, getting down to some obscure guy in Pennsylvania really drives it home.
Well, and unfortunately, that's just one example of what this Department of Justice and FBI have been up to, including the rounding up, basically, of large numbers of prominent senior subordinates and other, you know, assistants to Donald Trump, the former president of the United States, in the wake of that raid.
Yeah.
And we've talked in this program before with you, George, about the extent to which the subpoenas that are being executed and the seizures of phones and other electronic gear and so on are very problematic in terms of the general warrant problem that our Bill of Rights is supposed to protect us against.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything further that we ought to be thinking about in this particular context of the election as to what are the stakes for the rest of us?
Well, the stakes are substantial. I mean, among your viewers, and if you support a conservative organization, you know, the Eagle Forum of Alabama, great example. You know, they've been in business for over 50 years advocating conservative policies in the state legislature there. They've had all their records subpoenaed. And they're not even a party to the lawsuit that's the subject of the subpoena. And so, you know,
we had Becky Garrettson, the president of Uniform Alabama, on this program talking about it. It's shocking.
Yeah.
And I think your point is, in this case, as in so many others, this could be a question of who's next.
Yeah, absolutely. And believe me, if you're a conservative out there watching this program and you don't vote in this election, you very well may be next.
Yeah. Well, you may be next, even if you do vote in this election, if the election is stolen. And one of the things that you've been working hard on, I know, George, is election integrity. I mean, throughout your career, I think this has been one of your principal preoccupations. Give us a quick assessment of where we are on that score.
Well, we're moving in the right direction in many states. The problem is that in some key states, Democrat lawfare is holding up the implementation of good legislation for election integrity that was passed in the state legislature.
And by lawfare, you mean using the courts as a sort of weapon to block what they don't like?
Absolutely.
Even as they have used the courts to enact legislation effectively that they do like. I mean, lawfare is a double-edged sword for them, of course. Yeah. And the question, I guess, that occurs and will be weighing on a lot of prospective voters is, given that, are we likely to see some of the same opportunities for electoral fraud or misconduct, at least, that we saw in 2020 repeated?
On a state-by-state basis, I think the most crucial state is Pennsylvania. Their Democrats have been unabashed in their efforts to make sure that they can steal the election the same way that they did in 2020.
And our friend Charles Sam Fattis has said Republicans are not proving to be very helpful in this regard, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, well, you know,
I have to leave it at that. George, we're hard out of time. Come back to us soon to complete that thought and so much more. God bless you, my friend. Next up, we're going to get a highlights reel of what we talked about in the Elite Capture webinar last week, and you're going to want to catch this right after this message. Welcome back to a very special segment of Securing America. We're going to give you, well, a very short but impactful précis of a webinar that we did last week under the auspices of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. It's about the unrestricted warfare that China is waging against us. We talk about it a lot here. We talk about these webinars a lot too, and I hope this introduction to one of our best about the Chinese Communist Party's elite capture in our country will inspire you to subscribe to these webinars so that you don't miss any of them and you can easily get your hands on all of them. They're really valuable resources for understanding the danger we're facing from that quarter and from people who are helping it happen to us. Check this out.
The Chinese Communist Party, being a corrupt enterprise itself, spreads corruption wherever it goes. Its tools are money, sex, and drugs. The use of monetary inducements, I think, is common to all intelligence agencies, and all follow roughly the same formal process of recruitment. But, of course, how China differs is not just in its widespread use of money, but drugs and sex as well. And, of course, it differs a little bit in its use of overseas Chinese, all of whom are expected to be loyal to their ancestral land, even if they've been here for two or three generations. Finally, it differs, I think, in the sheer scale of its effort. Back in the late 90s, I worked with the Talks Commission investigating the espionage of China and the corruption in the Clinton campaign. At that time, there were an estimated 8,000 front organizations run by various PRC intelligence services. And every China scholar, I dare say, has been approached at some point. And unfortunately, many of them have succumbed to these inducements. So again, the effort is huge and ongoing, unprecedented, and we're not paying nearly enough attention to it.
In some instances, the CCP officials aren't necessarily looking for state secrets. They're simply looking for elites who are going to advance their interests. People sometimes think that elite capture might mean that an elected official whose family is doing business with China is now going to be robotically spouting Beijing's line. They don't expect that. What they're looking for is help on the big things that are most important to them. And those are primarily unrestricted access to Western capital markets, unrestricted access to our technology, and little or no restrictions on their ability to export goods into the United States. If you take a position favorable in those areas and you ding them occasionally for human rights, Beijing is very happy to do deals with you. It's an enormous problem in Washington, D.C. But elite capture is not just a political phenomenon. It also takes place in Wall Street and on Silicon Valley. If you look at the biggest firms on Wall Street, BlackRock, Blackstone, they take postures, policy positions that are highly favorable towards China. In fact, when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on China, Chinese officials wanting to make their case in the United States didn't actually go to Washington, D.C. first. They went to Wall Street, to the biggest firms, and said to those firms, you need to fix this if you want to continue to have deals in China and access to our financial markets. Silicon Valley is also an enormous problem. If you look at Bill Gates, if you look at Google, if you look at Facebook, all of these companies and their leaders take highly favorable postures towards Beijing, China. People ask me sometimes, you know, what is the motivation here? I believe that the appeal for many of the elites in Silicon Valley is they admire the dictatorial model of Beijing. And you see people say this, people like Elon Musk say this all the time. They like the fact that things are done so efficiently in China. And so that means that they have engaged and been captured by Beijing.
What we're talking about here is something that is done very, very deliberately by the Chinese government under a whole of government concept. So basically every point of contact with the Chinese government, or really any Chinese entity, is exploited for the purpose of capturing the elite of a target country. And by this point, probably every country is a target country, very deliberately, very methodically, in a very, very organized fashion. The Chinese Communist Party pursues capturing getting their hooks into, controlling the elite of target countries. Certainly the United States is at the top of that list. So they're not just looking to be your friend or anything that's just might be painted in some sort of neutral fashion. They want to control, manipulate, and direct the elite in the United States for the purposes of having them pursue policies that are beneficial to the Chinese Communist Party. It's that straightforward. It is that blatant. And it happens on a massive, like, industrial scale. That's the bottom line with what elite capture is all about. It is turning all of these individuals, and the Biden administration, again, is full of them, turning them so that they are working for Beijing and not for us.
If you were Xi Jinping and you wanted to take down the United States, and I mean take down physically, not just dominate economically, would you want to spend billions of dollars on a trade war that would hurt your own economy and set your own people against you, your own elites against you? Would you want to prematurely risk a multi-trillion dollar shooting war? And I say prematurely because there will come a time when they will do this. Or would you rather spend a few billion dollars buying up American elites? The Chinese work with the left using ideology. The people like Dianne Feinstein, who have deep communist pasts, and Judy Chu from California, who used to be involved with the Communist Workers' Party. These people will work with China willingly on ideological grounds. But there is money involved too. So they get the left with money and ideology. They get the right with money. The Chinese, through intermediaries or directly, get control of very important people. It's a very cheap way of bringing down a country. It's way cheaper than war. It's way cheaper than economic combat. But the end result is the same, and it paves the way for that kinetic war that we know is coming. They capture enough of our elites, they weaken the country enough that they can basically march into a conquered country. And that is Chinese strategy.